You're listening to a Mash Those Buttons podcast, brought to you ad-free with the support of our patrons. Visit mashthosebuttons.com or stay tuned after the show for more details. Hello and welcome to the Mash Those Buttons show, where we cover the latest in games, community culture, and everything in between. This week we are talking about Ghost of Tsushima. We're going to talk about false advertising and The Last of Us Part 2. And we're also going to talk a bit about the price of games development, or I should say the price of games versus the cost of game development. This is episode number 19. We are recording for the week of July 20th, and for anybody listening for the first time, welcome. I am Jarrett, but you can call me Ja, and I am here with the Games Industry Public Defender and the Scourge of Ironforge, Nick Zelenkevich.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
I'd like to thank you guys for taking the time to listen, and I'd also like to thank and welcome any returning listeners. I'd like to give a special thanks to our supporters in both Patreon and our Twitch subscribers. If you want to know when we go live on Twitch, just follow us at twitch.tv/mashthosebuttons. And you can also give us a follow on Twitter at twitter.com/themashnetwork. And we'd love to have you join our Discord, which is mash.gg/discord. You can meet myself, Nick, and hang out with the other awesome Discord members. Now let's hop right into it. We'll get started with what I call the game of the week. This is actually a pretty active week for game releases, now that I'm thinking about it. Like, you had Rocket League. You had Ghost of Tsushima. There was another game. I can't remember the name of it, though. And I think next week is Carrion, so it's actually a pretty...
Carrion comes out next week already?
I think it does.
Damn.
So, pretty soon. Well, it might be this week. Sorry. We're recording in the past.
Always more impressive than recording from the future.
Oh. Yeah, but... Yeah, we're talking about Ghost of Tsushima that came out on Friday, Thursday. Well, I guess technically it was still Friday because, 12 midnight, it's still Friday. But Ghost of Tsushima is here. This is the last PS4 exclusive, exclusive PlayStation game coming out for the PS4. I'll just start with the way it looks. It's fucking beautiful, man. Like, I'm actually like, I can't wait to see what it actually looks like on the PS5. This has to be one of those games that's going to be PS5 compatible. And while I don't necessarily expect it to take advantage of the, faster hard drive, the better graphical hardware, I'm pretty sure it will. So I'm excited for that. I mean, the game looks so good. I don't even want to fight anybody. I just kind of want to be there in the world, like, oh man, this place is amazing. It's like, is this what Japan actually looks like? I don't even know if it looks like that now, those areas, So yeah, but it is an absolutely gorgeous game. And the funny thing is, like, from a graphical fidelity standpoint, it's not the best either. Like, The Last of Us, graphically speaking, looks better. I'd say even Spider-Man, graphically speaking, looks better than this game. But it's just the way I guess it's the color palette, They really, one of the things that they focused on in this game is, trying to make it look like a samurai movie to a degree, I guess. I mean, they do have that mode where you can actually go black and white and the wind is blowing all the time and stuff like that. And I did not turn that on. I don't even have the Japanese language on. I'm English subtitles, so somebody can email us and tell me how I'm doing it wrong, but I don't care. Yeah, but no, like, it's just the way, like, you're going through the different areas and the colors of the foliage changes and stuff like that. And you know, you're riding your horse through a field of like white flowers and stuff. It just looks cool. It looks really, really cool. So, but I've probably played about, I don't know, close to 10 hours of the game. I have not made it out of the first act. The game is broken into acts. I don't know how many there are, but I haven't gotten past the first act yet, and I'll probably get into why here in a little bit. But from the start of the game, they get you to the action pretty fast, to be perfectly honest with you, which is refreshing coming from games like, you know, just coming off of The Last of Us Part 2. Even something like God of War, you know, doesn't really get you into the action that fast. It kind of set the tone, set the mood. And in this game, the game starts, and I'm going to mention what stunning things that happen at the very beginning of the game. I'm talking about within like the first 30 minutes here. And, you know, the game starts with you play as Jin, and you're there with your uncle, who's a lord. You're both lords, but you're preparing for an attack from the Mongols. The Mongols are getting ready to land on the beach of Tsushima. And they say something back and forth for a couple minutes, and then they charge into battle. And first of all, they did a great job displaying the difference between the Mongols and the samurai. You know, they sent like a samurai down to the beach to challenge the strongest warrior, and the strongest warrior comes out, throws like some alcohol, throws like wine on him, and then sets him on fire. That's how the game started. And actually I probably shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. That's a spoiler. they charge in the battle, and, it doesn't go well. I'll just leave it at that. And the whole first act is basically about the aftermath of that, you know, kind of getting back on your feet. Your uncle's been captured, so you need help getting your uncle back, you know, stuff like that. So, I said the game moves forward and acts, but I do like the fact that they kind of just got you right to it, because you get straight to the combat from there. And at first, the combat's pretty simple. I mean, the combat's still pretty simple, but you have like a light attack, a heavy attack. You have a block, which if you block at the right time, it's a parry. You also have a dodge. So if you, you can do like a one step dodge, which will give you a chance to, you know, hit somebody back, or you can do like a dodge roll, which is something you can upgrade to a bit later, you know? So the combat is what you would come to expect in an action game. I mean, honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, this might be the best Assassin's Creed game I've ever played. and that's not saying something about, Sucker Punch. Yeah, that's actually saying something about Ubisoft. That's Ubisoft's fault that they turned Assassin's Creed into a generic action game. It is. Like, Assassin's Creed is a generic action game. It's the best Assassin's Creed game I've ever played. If this is successful, I wouldn't be surprised if they start working on like a Japanese Assassin's Creed game. I would not be surprised if that happens.
People have been clamoring for that for a while anyway.
They have, but now you got to match up with this. You know what Ubisoft is not? They are not good storytellers. So that's, they have to pretty much compete with this game now, which is actually telling. I will, at first, the story wasn't compelling me all that much. It just wasn't. So I actually spent a lot of time not doing the main story stuff. Which is why I'm probably still in Act 1. But, yeah, if a Ubisoft came out with an Assassin's Creed Japan game, I wouldn't even expect the story to be anywhere near as good as this one was. So far. Not even past the first act. Yeah, but, yeah, combat is it's pretty simple. And it actually, now it's another Assassin's Creed reference, like, it actually plays a lot closer to the older Assassin's Creeds than the new ones, because the new Assassin's Creed, you just kind of get in there and start like, you know, hammering away at people. With this one, the enemy doesn't always surround you, but they try to, you know, they try to get around you. And then you just kind of, you need to wait until they make a move. And then you do an action. So if they do a certain move, maybe you parry that move and then attack. And then if maybe they do a different move, maybe you dodge that move instead and then you attack, you know, just for example. So it does kind of work like the older Assassin's Creed games in that aspect, but it makes sense, you know, because, you know, samurai weren't, and I'm not a samurai expert, don't get me wrong, but I never heard of a samurai just hacking away at somebody. You know what I'm saying? It's not like medieval combat. It's like measured, you know.
There are stories, and my source for this is the Bushido Blade, the book that came with Bushido Blade, because that game is old enough that you still got little books with your games. But there are stories of a samurai who would get into battle with another samurai, and both would just stand there unmoving for days, waiting for the opponent to flinch and give that little opening that they could exploit. So,
right, yeah. I'm sure that's 100% accurate. Yeah. So it actually makes a lot more sense. It makes a lot of sense that the combat is like that in this game. So, you know, in the beginning, you're kind of just attack, you know, you're in the middle of a huge battle, so the attacks are just happening. Later on in the game, when you're approaching battles, like you see enemies, you can do a standoff where they do that thing where they stand there until the enemy, you know, somebody tries to make move. So, you know, you don't stand there for days, obviously. You don't even stand there for that long of a time. But what ends up happening is they tell you to hold the triangle button, and when the enemy goes to attack, you let it go, and you'll do like a single move that will kill that enemy, right?
That makes sense, though, because you figure, like, you've got to keep the pressure on the triangle button. If you let go too early, like, if you don't actively stay there, if you let your thumb stamina flag, then, yeah, you could expose yourself, and you could be the vulnerable one.
Absolutely. You got it, Nick. You can actually upgrade that a little later so that you can hit two or even three people. Like, you know, you get the first person, one other person charges, then you get them, and then the next person charges, then you get them. A lot of the things that they do in this game are for cinematic purposes, so it can place the camera angle in certain areas, you know, place camera in certain areas so you get certain, you know, kind of pictures. Like, they really want you to take screenshots in this game, so much that the screenshot button or the camera button is on the D-pad. Huh. It's a button on the D-pad. Yeah, it's fucking annoying because I hit it sometimes. I'm like, god damn it. But and speaking of the camera feature, they want, instead of just being able to take a picture, you can actually put the camera in different points and it'll animate it for you. So you can make your own little movie if you want to, which is actually pretty cool. So, yeah, you can do those standoffs, which is that, and sometimes you get lucky. Like, if you can stand off against the most powerful enemy in an area, oh god, that's the best, because you don't got to worry about them later. Because it doesn't matter what type of enemy they are. Like, I've gone into places and like there are these leaders in some of the places, and I'll do a standoff and it'll be the leader. I'm like, oh, thank god. And you know, you just chop them in half and that's pretty much the end of it. So while you're fighting too, besides, you know, what I've already told you, there are different stances you can take, and each stance has an advantage against a specific type of enemy. So if the enemy is using swords, you should use like stone stance. If the enemy is using shields, you should use water stance. And if it's like using like axes or spears, you can use wind stance. It's like a fourth stance too, and I can't remember the name of it right now. But yeah, like, and what it does, it actually changes your moveset a little bit. So I think your light attack remains the same for the most part, but your heavy attack changes, and it gives you it's more advantageous against an enemy. So water stance, for example, when you apply water stance and then you use your heavy attack, you do more like stun damage on the enemy. Because for enemies with shields, you have to like basically break their stance before you can actually attack them. So it's pretty cool. Like, they do a good job, I think, gradually putting more enemies into the game, which is actually kind of difficult in an open world game, since you can go anywhere you want. Like, I never went anywhere and felt like I was just, like, outmatched or outclassed or anything like that, you know? It starts off with basic enemies, like, okay, this guy has one sword, this guy has a shield, this guy has a lance. Up now, this guy has two swords. Uh-oh, this guy has a really big shield. Uh-oh, this guy has a really big sword. Okay, this guy throws bombs. This guy has bows. You know, so there is quite a bit of a mix-up in terms of the enemies. There's also animal enemies, too. So you can be out in the wild and, like, get attacked by a bear or a boar or, like, a dog, you know, stuff like that. So there's a bunch of variation there. I want to say the biggest problem with combat is that there is no lock-on system. You cannot lock on to an enemy, and this causes problems with the camera. Because there have been times where I just have not been able to see enemies and I have to manually swing my camera around, or like I will be fighting somebody and then because the camera is third person, so the camera is pushed out from him and then the camera will actually go behind a wall and I can't see the fight at all anymore, you know? So it's a bit cumbersome. They said that they did that on purpose because they wanted you to be able to flow from one enemy to the other, which that's what you're supposed to do. Like, see which enemy is going to attack and then basically deal with that enemy. And I get it, but it's still, no, they still needed some type of lock-on system. Even if the lock-on system was, you had to hold the button while you were locked on. And then if you wanted to switch, you let go of that and then you did your attack. Because, it's just very, very frustrating. And it can ruin some of the combat experiences. You know? So, yeah, that's the only complaint I have about combat. Now, stealth is something that's also in the game, but it's weird because it's frowned upon. But not by the game. Like, to my knowledge, there is no negative impact on the game itself if you use stealth, right? It's more of a moral thing. Like every time you use stealth, Jin basically talks to himself and he's like, we have to do it this way. It has to be done this way. Because the way of the samurai is that you do everything in somebody's face, right? That's the code. And, you know, you come across some situations where you have no choice but to use stealth, right? Where, for example, like if there's hostages in an area and the enemies are there, if you alert the enemies, they're going to try to kill the hostages, right? If you stealth the whole thing, you don't have to worry about that. Now, one thing I did find out a little later is that you get an indicator when an enemy is going to kill a hostage. So you do have, you know, some warning in who's going to do it. Like they tell you which enemy is going to kill somebody and you can do it that way. I really hope there is no negative effect on the game if you use stealth, because there's no warning of it at all, which would be a bit frustrating. You know, there's some situations that I've been doing now where I have done stealth a little bit, or I've stealthed an entire area, but if there is a negative impact in the game, I probably would have just did standoffs the whole time. We did like a standoff in a clean fight. Now, obviously, going into a guarded area and doing a standoff is tough. It's hard because enemies will attack at the same time. Let you know, like, or they'll hit you with these crazy combos and end up killing you. And that's another thing. The deaths in this game, it's a bit rough. Like they let you revel in your failure, because when you lose all your health, you go to the ground, like you go down to the ground, but you're not dead yet. And then one of the enemies comes to you and he like either puts a sword through you or he slices your throat. Sometimes they kick you around a few times. Like, yeah. It's like, yeah, it is vicious. So don't do it. don't get knocked down. All right. But yeah, I mean, the main gameplay is around the combat and the stealth, but there are a couple of other things. You know, you do these missions, but they're not called missions. They're called tales, right? So there's three types of tales, at least so far. There are the main tales that are for the story. There are these like side tales kind of. And sometimes those have their own story arcs, right? So I have two tales right now that are 9 tales long. Like, it tells you how many missions you have or how many tales you have in this one story arc. And I'm like, that seems like a lot. Those are like the first two you get, by the way. And they're like 18 missions collectively. But you don't have to do them in order to progress. But they're there. So you have those. But then you also have Mythic Tales. Now, those are fun. Those are fun. Because, one, you get really cool stuff from finishing them, right? You get either like a mythic item, like a piece of armor or something like that, or you'll get a brand new move. And they're usually based on legend, you know, like they're myths. So the first one that I got was about a guy who, I forget what the name of the technique is, like some type of lightning technique. Like you basically move so fast that the enemies can't see you. And they told this whole story about how he made the technique and how he used it against a group of wolves. It was really cool. I was going to tell the story, but I'm not going to, because you should see it. And they animated the whole thing. Like they drew it. And I don't even know what, like that. I don't know what style it is. I don't even want to butcher it, but it was actually, really cool. So I like doing those, and they show up differently on the map, but they're usually always worth doing. And the ones I've done so far are actually pretty long. So yeah, it's actually pretty awesome. The way that they have that. Until the story started picking up, at least for me, I like doing those missions better than I did the main missions, to be honest with you. So there is a leveling system, but it's not called leveling. It's called growing your legend, right? So all of your actions you do will help grow your legend. So if you do a tale, it'll actually tell you how much your legend is growing, right? Or if you do, sometimes you'll just find stuff in the open world, right? You'll just find, like, there's a group of Mongolians, there are some hostages, something. You'll find them, you'll finish it, and you'll get, you know, some legend, right? And as you grow your legend, you'll get technique points to put into your tree, and I'll get into that in a second. But what actually ends up happening is, like, every time you finish, you know, I guess a piece of the legend, your title moves, like you get a different title. And so it'll be like one title is like the Wandering Samurai, and the other one's like the People's Hope. And every time you level up enough, you end up unlocking a ghost weapon. So those are things that will help you in stealth, right? Like you can unlock these like little balls that make these that chimes that make noise. Or one of my favorite now is the sticky bomb. you can sticky bomb somebody and blow them up. You know, which that's a lot of fun to use in combat. But yeah, that's basically how you end up leveling up. But it really just adds that overall feel of the game. And I don't know how close it is to actually being like a samurai movie, because I'm not a samurai movie buff, but man, it feels like this is the way a samurai movie should be. You know? So those technique points I was talking about, you have like these, this is like these skill trees, and there's a lot of them. I don't know a lot of them, but it's quite a few. They're broken down into three branches. Like one is samurai techniques, and that has multiple trees you can go down, plus like some of the mythic stuff. And that usually deals with face-to-face battle stuff. So, what your character does when you get a perfect dodge, or when you get a perfect parry, or that you can now parry certain attacks that were not parryable. The ghost techniques are usually out of combat and for ghost weapons. So now you can chain assassinations, or now this is the same tree that I was talking about, the standoffs, where you can, instead of chopping down one person, you have the opportunity to chop down three. And then stance techniques are directed at specific attacks, specific stances. So whatever attacks you could do in that stance, you usually upgrade those. Then you also have like your gear, and your gear is what controls your stats. So like how much health you have, even though like you do have a base health. So if you have more health, how much damage you take, how well you can do stealth tactics. You also can apply charms, which are modifiers to those stats. And, I thought the upgrades for those were interesting because they come from a shared resource pool. You know, so you collect all these resources out in the world, and that includes killing animals too. So like you sometimes need like what are called predator hides from the more dangerous animals. And in order to upgrade, you have to go to a vendor. You can't just upgrade in place. So you have to go to a vendor in one of the towns, and they'll upgrade for you. But you have to be careful, because if you run out of resources doing one style of upgrade, then you won't be able to upgrade the rest. So that's the thing there. And yeah, man, it's just the world feels you get really rewarded for exploring, but I think you kind of have no choice but to explore, right? Because you do have a map, and you can put, or you could tell them on the map where you want to go, right? However, there's no like GPS line leading you where you need to go. There's this thing called the guiding wind. And the thing about the guiding wind is that you kind of have to pay attention to the screen while it's on, because it blows, it like literally blows trees and you have to go in the direction that the wind is blowing. But since you're paying so much attention to the screen, you see other things, right? Like you might see smoke in the distance. So you can go check out that smoke and there's probably something there. It could be a war camp. It could be like a survivor camp. It could be somebody with a mission. If you see these yellow birds flying around, follow the yellow bird. They'll take you to like a special location. Like they might take you to a hot spring and then you can get a health buff there. You know, if you see a fox, follow the fox. It'll lead you to like a shrine where you can possibly, or you can get points toward upgrading your, you know, how many charms you can carry and stuff like that, you know? So yeah, the one thing I didn't mention is the resolve system that they have. And basically the resolve system allows you to do a few things. It allows you to do certain special moves, right? Why are you shaking your head like that?
No, I was going to make a joke and then I was like, no.
It allows you to do special moves. It allows you to heal yourself in battle. You know, like you'll get more health. Like he beats on his chest and he like, you know, I guess as a sign of like showing resolve. But you can upgrade it so you can actually, if you go down and you have two resolve, you can get back up, you know? And I think that's important because certain things you do can get you more resolve. Like you can, there's these bamboo cutting stations and they're little mini games because you basically, like, you have to hit a button combination in a certain amount of time. Like from the time you hit the first button, you have to hit the last button before he finishes chopping, essentially.
Oh, okay.
And at first, there's only three. Then there's four. Then there's five. And you have to remember the combination and just kind of do it, you know? So, yeah, there's all types of stuff like that just around the map, you know? And sometimes you'll just, like, so I ran into a group of soldiers that were holding a guy hostage. There was no indicator taking me to him. And I could have rode right past him, but I was like, fuck it, I got off. Did a standoff, killed him, and I talked to the guy, and he gave me the location of, like, one of the war camps. And I was like, okay, nice. And speaking of the war camp, so, there's a lot of areas in the game, like Mongol-controlled territory. They have leaders there. If you kill a leader, there's a couple things you could do. You can observe a leader, or you can kill it. And when you do that, when you either observe or kill the leader, it actually gives you points toward opening a new stance. So it's very active. Everything in the game feels active, you know, to get your techniques up, you need technique points. That means you need to, you know, grow your legend. So that's a very active thing from the player. In order to get new stances, you have to, it's not just about making progress in the game. It's about actively going to these places where these leaders and then killing the leaders or observing the leaders. You know, so yeah, like everything feels pretty active. It's a very fun game. It's like if an Assassin's Creed game had a good story, except it feels a bit more polished. I will say that it does feel a bit more polished, and the music's better. I'll say that as well. So yeah, I'm really, really enjoying it, and I think maybe after it's done, I'll give it a couple weeks and go through it and to kind of take my time. Maybe I'll do like a final thoughts on it once it's done. But as it stands right now, I think this is a good release. This is a good final release for Sony on the PS4. A good curtain call for the PS4. So Nick is enthralled by the game, in case you couldn't tell. Listen to all he talked. I just basically talked by myself for like 30 minutes. Yeah.
It looks nice.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, it's definitely a good game. I would recommend it if you enjoy, like, it isn't definitely an action game. I wouldn't even call it, like, really an action RPG or anything like that, because now I don't think you make any decisions in the game. The game just kind of plays. So, yeah. But before we get into our two features that we have, I guess you can call them, we did want to talk about one more thing, which is the fact that Metacritic looks like they've changed how they handle user reviews in the wake of The Last of Us Part 2. So this is from an article from Forbes from Paul Tassi. He says, you know, when he went to go check out the Metacritic score on Ghost of Tsushima, the thing that he thought was weird was, you know, he saw the Metacritic score, but then he saw a box on the right hand side that said, please, you know, for user reviews, said, please spend some time playing the game. Come back to review it starting at 12 p.m. PST on July 18th. So that's about 24 hours, right? Because it came out on the 17th, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, they're trying, like, you know, because The Last of Us Part 2 got bombed, like, on release, pretty much. Where it was impossible. It got so many reviews, it was impossible for people to actually play the game. You know, I think I played The Last of Us Part 2 when it came out, and I played for 2 hours, and I got done with the first act, you can say, with The Last of Us Part 2. And the critic reviews were already bombed at that point. Well, not the critic reviews, sorry, the user reviews are already bombed. So Metacritic is trying to take a step to get these user reviews under control. One thing that they probably need to do, honestly, is probably just verify that you even play the game, you know. And they could do that if they make you log in with your PSN ID or your Xbox Live ID, check your achievements, you know, make sure you have at least one achievement from the game. So that would help.
I just wonder, like who is going by the user reviews that are posted in the first, let's say, hour after launch of a game? That because you have to figure, like, I understand, okay, the critical reviews, they get their review copies ahead of time, so it makes sense. You get, like, the official Metacritic score of what critics are saying. They have valid opinions. They have played the game, or at least been exposed to, you know, some part of the content that the developer or publisher wanted them to be exposed to. They have, you know, their job is to have an opinion. They have an opinion. You can use that information. But who is sitting there on the launch day of a game saying, I'm going to wait an hour to see what people have said about a game and then decide if I'm going to buy it or not? Because you can get those, you can get the professional views, but it's like, no, I want just the user opinion. Like, that, I can't imagine anybody's actually doing that, that anybody's actually weighing those opinions. There's no need for those opinions to exist. All that can happen is you're going to get people usually doing review bombing, but I suppose you may also get the inverse of people just posting early reviews out of hype. Like, I haven't played this game, but it looks amazing. I'm going to love this 10 out of 10. And there's no value in that. So, like, this should be the default for everything. It should apply to, like, movies as well and stuff. Like, you know, if you are thinking about seeing a movie on the day it comes out, like, what is word of mouth really going to affect your opinion on that? Like, I don't know. I think there's no harm in saying, like, okay, no, we'll wait for the general public has to wait like 24 hours, make sure they've seen the movie, played the game, you know, read the book, whatever it is that they're reviewing. Give them time to be exposed to it at least before they go in and do that. I mean, it really wouldn't stop the review bombing too much, because, I mean, you know, you could still be pissed off and be like, no, I'll just review bomb tomorrow. But but at the same time, though,
Deterrence works, though. It's
true. Also, it does give the people who aren't going to review bomb a chance to actually post, because, you know, especially in the beforehand, you know, the pre-review bombing, everybody just looking at the spoilers and the leaks and posting their opinion. Nobody's looking at that saying, yeah, you know, I'm going to go post an even-handed critique of this. And, like,
right.
You know, like, those don't come till later. So at least if people do try to review bomb, there's a chance for people to actually come in and honestly, you know, give their opinion and be like, oh no, it's actually not that bad. You should go check that out. And hopefully that would offset that.
Yeah, I mean, well, in terms of The Last of Us, I know a few people who decided not to get the game based on the user reviews because obviously there's just a massive distrust of the games media and the media in general. You know, and some people, they already, as soon as they heard the leak, right, they already knew in the back of their mind they weren't going to get it, but they needed to have their bias confirmed, right? Well, I knew the game was bad, you know, that's, they're just looking for that confirmation. So. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a step in the right direction, but some type of confirmation or, you know, verification is what I think needs to happen next for Metacritic.
I'm just disappointed that all those people who actually looked and decided not to buy The Last of Us hurt its sales.
That's sarcasm. All right, so let's move on. I think about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, me, Nick, and Corbar got together. We talked about an article that came out about The Last of Us Part 2 and, you know, how people were calling out Naughty Dog for false advertising. So we talked about that a little bit, talked about if Naughty Dog was actually false advertising and if it matters. So there you go. All right, here with Nick and Corbara. And we're going to be talking about The Last of Us 2 and how disappointed everybody was. Actually, disappointed is the wrong word. Betrayed is the word that I would use. I'd say, what was it? Well, actually, I would say hours after The Last of Us 2 came out, got review bombed. But even before it came out, it was getting like bombed on Metacritic.
Yeah.
When the leaks came out. But one of the big problems that people are having is saying that The Last of Us 2 was falsely advertised.
This is bullshit.
And this, they're saying it was falsely advertised because I think there were trailers and screenshots that have Joel in it, and either his model is replaced with like an older model to make it look like it's modern times, when in the game it's actually a younger version of Joel. And also there are trailers where Joel is in a place where Joel is not in the actual game. So people are saying, hey, that you falsely advertised the game, making it seem like Joel was in the game. This is an excellent defense or excellent example of why you should not watch game trailers. I'm just going to start with this because, and then we're going to move, I guess we're going to move into a bit of a spoil territory here because we have no choice, unfortunately. But I didn't look at a single leak or anything, but I kind of already put together that Joel was going to die in this game.
Same.
The box, like if you read the box description, it does not mention him at all. It says Ellie goes on like a revenge spree or some shit like that after a violent event happens. Nothing about Joel on it.
Well, even before that stuff, all the stuff that they did when they announced the game at the times, they showed focused on Ellie.
Right. Yeah. So it's like, I didn't watch a single trailer, but I also didn't get into the leaks. And when I read the box, I was like, yeah, like I'm pretty sure Joel's going to die. So it wasn't a surprise. But yeah, I can see how if you watch those trailers, you could get those ideas. Now, Nick, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I think part of it, though, is that the whole reason you watch the trailers is not to get spoiled. The whole reason they did this was to not spoil it so that you could watch the trailers. The problem is that we're so used to trailers being a representation of what you will get, that you see something in the trailer and, you know, 90% of the time, 95% of the time, you know, that's actually something that's going to be in there. And in this case, it wasn't. I think what people need to do is they need to adjust their expectations of what a trailer is. A trailer shouldn't be like, here's what you're going to get in this story, because that's the one thing everybody complains. You have like movies where it's like they tell you the entire arc of the movie in the trailer, and like, yeah, okay, that's great if you want to go to something, you just kind of turn your brain off and be like, oh, you know, here's the emotional journey I'm going to go on. I'm fine not really having any shocks. But like on some level, like people just need to accept like the trailer is more like, this is the flavor you can expect. This is the type of thing you can expect. We're not actually going to tell you what to expect. It's kind of like when you play like a demo. Like some demos are the first level of the game. You play that, and then you have the opportunity at the end to buy more of the game and continue that. Some demos, it's like, Here's a completely different level. It has nothing to do with the, you know, the game that you're playing, other than it's, you know, the assets and, you know, the character and the gameplay. And if you like that, well, now here's the actual game that you can go in and, you know, and it's, you know, you start with a different character and a whole different thing. But, you know, if you like the demo, if you like the style and the feel of that, you will like this game. And I think people are so conditioned to think the trailer is promising you something when they need to change that. Just expect that it's promising you an experience, not, no, this is fact. What you see in the trailer is fact. Mm-hmm. The Marvel movies do this brilliantly.
Exactly. That's basically what I was going to say. Like, movies do this all the time. They want to get you hyped up, excited for the movie. They use angles and stuff to trick you into thinking something's going to happen when actually something completely different is going to be happening in the movie. They don't want to ruin the experience, but they want you to want to come and partake in that experience.
In Infinity War, there was that shot in the trailer of all the heroes running together in the jungle that was not in the movie at all. And nobody complained about false advertising there because everybody was blown away by the movie. The problem here is that people already had an axe to grind with this. And so now they're like, okay, now I've got some ammo and I can grind that axe on. Okay. That's a terrible metaphor, but you know, now I can, you know, now I've got, you know, I'm pissed off and now I've got something to use with that. And that's the whole reason they're complaining. If it turned out Joel wasn't, you know, dead, if it turned out like Joel was elected president or something and he's just off being awesome somewhere and everybody loved the story, they would have no problem with this. They'd be like, oh, that was so great that they masked that in the trailer. That was brilliant by Naughty Dog. And instead, because they didn't like the change that was made, they're pissed off.
Well, I would agree that they're pissed off because they didn't like the change. But at the same time, this is not like the Infinity War trailer. Because the Infinity War trailer, like, I mean, that's a scene that could have been, well, obviously it was recorded because, you know, it was in the trailer, but it doesn't impact the story. That scene being in it has no impact to the story.
I don't want to derail this discussion too much, but I would argue that as you're watching that movie and you're thinking like, wait, there's this scene where the heroes rally that's coming. I know that the heroes are going to rally. I know that's coming. And then the heroes don't rally. That could impact the story if you focus on that at the time.
But they did rally to a degree. That's the thing.
But not that sequence. You're waiting at the end there, and you're like, wait, when are they going to? And then the credits hit, and you're like, wow, they didn't show the rally.
Yeah, but the thing about it is, like, this completely changes the game. Like, in some of the scenes, like, if you play the game, it's not even, like, a young Joel versus an old Joel. It is a completely different character in that spot that said those lines. So they specifically recorded, you know, these lines and put that animation in it just to kind of fool you, you know? So I think it's more than just having an axe to grind here. I mean, yeah, lots of people didn't like the fact that Joel died. They didn't like the fact... they didn't like who did it, how she looked, and some other stuff. Like, I don't want to spoil the game too much that kind of, you know, happens in it. I mean, I can understand the anger here, but my thing about this specifically, about The Last of Us 2, is such a it was so highly anticipated, right? The Last of Us was such a critical success that they didn't have to show any of that stuff, and the game still would have sold very well. They could have done a gameplay trailer, you know. Actually, they did. I think, was it 2016, 2017? I forget, where they showed Ellie in Seattle fighting the enemy known as a Scar. I'm pretty sure it was the Scars. Yeah,
yeah, it was a Scar
that she fought. Yeah, so she was fighting the Scars, and it was like a trailer that they did. They could have just did that to show off the combat, show off that you can like go prone now, enemies can find you, to show off all that stuff. They can have showed all that stuff off without having this like smoke and mirrors type of trailer. So to a degree, I feel like it's on them that they set these expectations. I think the reaction was a bit much, you know, like you can be upset. You can even say that you're upset, you know. But some of the reactions that Naughty Dog has gotten, or the voice actors, or Neil Druckmann have gotten, the threats and stuff like that, obviously that's just too much. Like, I can understand being like angry about it. I can even understand giving a low review score because of it, you know.
But taking it out on the people who actually aren't responsible for it is a different story.
Right. Well, don't get me wrong. I'm pretty sure Neil Druckmann is responsible for those trailers.
That part, yes. I mostly mean like the voice actors and some people who do the animations. It's like they're told to do that. So,
wait, I was ready to completely blame Laura Bailey for this advertising campaign.
Oh, yeah. Completely her fault, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I get it. Like, I don't like, I'm not saying that I don't think these people are completely, you know, wrong here. For this, I mean, most of the tweets I saw, like in terms of this, where people were just comparing what it was versus what you got. I mean, they have a point, you know. Like, and Naughty Dog did this on purpose to make you think, like, to kind of, I guess, surprise you about the story. But they already knew the story was going to be divisive. They said so before the game released, you know, and I think they wanted it to be to a degree, you know. So, yeah, I mean, in this case, I think Naughty Dog kind of dug their own grave. Like, they reap what they sowed. There was no reason for them to do this besides the shock factor and making you want to feel something. And people felt something. They felt something, for sure.
They dug their own grave. And, yeah, they, you know, putting aside the death threats and stuff like that, and I do feel for the, you know, the voice actors especially getting hammered and whatnot, but they dug their own grave to the tune of 4 million copies sold in a week. You know, like, people can be pissed off about this, and they don't have a legal leg, you know, ground to stand on, I don't think, as far as like a false advertising or whatever. I mean, trailer, you know, trailers are traditionally sort of, you know,
misleading.
Yeah, intentionally misleading. There's no, I don't think there's any law that says a trailer has to be 100% accurate, but, you know, tell me now if The Last of Us 3 were to come out, you know, people aren't gonna, you know, all these people that are complaining and like, oh, this was wrong or whatever, tell me that they're actually gonna, you know, put their money where their mouth is and not buy The Last of Us 3. Now that they're all, for as pissed as they are for whatever reason, Neil Druckmann got their money, and so he can sit there in the grave that he dug and just lay on the pile of money that he's filled it with.
He did. I mean, he definitely did, but at the same time, I do think this kind of damaged the brand a bit. I think so. I know people who are like, you know, they weren't like super mad at it. Actually, they weren't mad at this in particular. They weren't mad at the themes in the game or anything like that. And they're just kind of like, I don't think I would get the next one. like if it came out.
You know, that could be, you know, I think we talked about this before, but I don't think that could be why he's like, I don't really have plans for Last of Us 3. That might be the kind of thing you do. You're like, mm-hmm. You know, we'll do the two and we're out. So let's just burn these bridges.
I was fine with the ending on the first one, but I did enjoy my time in the second one, so I'll be buying the third one if it does come out.
There was no way Sony was just going to sit on that. Like,
I know.
There was no way Sony was just going to sit on that. You know, and Sony's probably going to press for a third. Actually, I already know what the story of the third can be. Neil Druckmann, holler at me. I got the whole thing for you, buddy. Yeah.
Add it to, like, number 30 or 50 of the predictions made right by Jostradamus.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's... You know, with the way the game ended, I can really only see one path forward, to be honest with you. You know, so it's I don't know. They can definitely do. I know, like, one of the things about developing this game, they said one of the reasons it took them so long was because they had to find a compelling story, like they did in the first one. I kind of think they failed on that aspect. In my personal opinion, I think it kind of failed on that aspect. Which, you know, if you listen to We Are Survivors, when we get to the end of the game, I will kind of go through all of that and explain it. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, more so in the thing about the game that I like the most is really the combat systems and the foliage systems. Like, it's now a stealth game, you know, which is awesome. It was kind of a stealth game before. Wasn't a very good stealth game. Now it's actually a pretty good stealth game.
Especially when you figure out the mechanics, it becomes an amazing stealth game. You're like, oh, I can do this? Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then or you can flip it and make it an awesome combat game too. So, but yeah, in terms of the false advertising, you know, like I was like, okay, like that's kind of cheap. I wasn't like mad at it, but I can understand why somebody would be upset at it, especially if you were a Joel fan. That's another thing. I wasn't a Joel fan. I've made my thoughts on Joel very clear. You know. So, it is what it is.
Yeah, I understand why he did it, but I wasn't a fan either.
I just want to see Druckmann when they do The Last of Us 3. The first scene in the first trailer is somebody kills Abby. And then it turns out that doesn't actually happen in the game. She's the main player the next game.
All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Till next time.
Okay. So in that episode that we actually didn't release, there was actually a conversation in there about the price of games and how the price of games probably needs to go up, or probably will go up, I should say. So me and Nick talk about that a little bit, and you'll hear that now. All right. So Sean Layton, who has a marvelous beard now.
Amen.
Yeah. Like, you got to see the picture. I don't know. Maybe that should be the image for this week's episode. Sean Layton with his beard.
That should be the image for every episode.
Yeah. So, he was talking on, I think it was Game Lab Live. And I mean, his talk, I mean, like, what the discussion they were having hit a bunch of points, but one of the major points was that, you know, AAA development is not sustainable the way it is. He brought up some good points that the cost of AAA development has gone up, but the price tag really hasn't. I mean, games have been $60, I want to say, since 2005. That's when the Switch really happened to 60. It was 50 before. And honestly, I can't remember what the prices of games were before 50 bucks, because I wasn't paying for them. I was too young. So yeah, but yeah, it was 60 bucks. And then, yeah, it's just been that way since, I want to say, at least 2005 with the PS3 and the Xbox 360. And we do know that the price of game development has gone up, and you would think that the price of game development would kind of go down because, you know, especially as the console cycle goes through the motions, mainly because they get better tools to work with the games. You know, they know what they're doing now, so it should take less time to do certain things. Like, for example, like one of the great things about the Unreal Engine 5 is that it does a bunch of stuff that would normally take a long time for you, you know, and that's basically what technology does. Or for the developers. But at the same time, you have to take a look at the fact that they're not doing the same things over and over again. So as they're learning how to, you know, different techniques to maybe create an open world, like, I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty of it, right? Or to create a FPS, when they become more efficient at it, they find more things that they can do. They can add in more features, more innovations, make the worlds bigger. And that's, I guess that's maybe more the thing right there, is that our open worlds are becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, you know?
Well, let's not forget though, that the salaries for artists, for developers and whatnot, they've presumably scaled up as well. That, you know, I don't assume that, you know, developer today is making what they were making back in 2005, is making what they were making back in the 90s and whatnot. So even if, as the life cycle of a console goes on, where they can get more efficient in their output, I think that it's not like the cost kind of goes down. The other problem with that too is that, though, what you would wind up seeing if that were the case is that the cost would go down as the console ages, but then as soon as you hit the next console generation, the cost is going to ramp up significantly because all that optimization that you had built in is now lost.
Right. Well, they say that every time there's a console generation, you're going to see almost a double, like the production cost of a game is almost going to double, because it is harder usually to develop a game at the beginning of a console cycle. I don't know how true that's going to be this console cycle. I mean, I do understand, like, there are differences now, right, that you wouldn't see before, like, you know, with the super fast IO of the PS4, and obviously now, you know, the NVIDIA hardware is using I forget what they're called, but they're basically like they're not just for graphics processing, they're for AI, so that the AI can optimize the game and help it run smoother and things like that. So things are changing, but in the previous generations, you know, you had completely different architectures, like, you had to deal with, which is one of the reasons it was so difficult, and vastly different hardware, you know. So yeah, but actually, the thing you said about the price, not the price, but the salary of developers and artists. I don't think it's going up that much, to be perfectly honest with you. What other industry do the regular workers like have the salaries gone up with inflation? Well, mine certainly hasn't.
I think part of it is that you need to do some job hopping in there. You can't just stay at the same studio, but I think because it sounds like you're asking like why is the cost of development going up so much, and we don't really seem to have a reason for that.
I didn't ask that question. Did it sound like I was asking the question? I was stating a fact. No, I was stating a fact. It's like the cost of development does go up. You know, I said you would think that it would go down, but the things you have to take into consideration are that where the games are getting bigger. So even if they learn how to do something faster, now they could just do more of it, because we're not playing the same games we were even the year before. Like the games we're getting right now are some of the best in existence that have ever been created. God of War, Red Dead Redemption, even The Last of Us 2 with its combat system. You know, these are things that now the bar has been moved up, and to impress people, now you have to make something over the bar. Like, I don't even know what they're going to do for God of War 2. I have no idea how you can make that game better than just doing more of it. You know, that's the thing, but they're going to have to do it. But, you know, in terms of the price of games, like you said, it's been stuck at around $60, but developers have been trying to, or actually not developers, publishers have been trying to find ways to get more money out of their titles. You know, I mean, first of all, this is where games as a service comes from, is that you make the game and then you just continue to milk money out of it because it's a service. And I shouldn't say milk money, but you continue. It's a generator, right? It generates money for you over and over and over again consistently. And there's a couple ways you could do that. Like you can have a straight up MMO like World of Warcraft, you know, that is still Blizzard's moneymaker right there. That's why they can just lackadaisically make games the way they do. Well, until Daddy Activision got involved, they were able to do that. that's why they have that type of attitude. But you know, there's also DLC, which I think DLC was a great idea. It was a great idea. You take a game and you could just keep making content for it and you know, keep the people happy. But oh my God, Activision killed that shit. Ooh. They destroyed the idea of DLC, and EA too. EA did not help, but man, they took that idea and just made everybody hate it, especially with the way they handled Call of Duty, especially in the beginning, where to get access to old maps, you would have to pay to get access to old maps. I'm just like, wow. I mean, actually Destiny 2 did the same thing. Hi, Bungie. You can't escape this conversation. And in my opinion, they did it a little worse, because what they did was they took the old maps and reskinned them for new planets.
Yes.
And then put that into an expansion. I was like, wow. I got onto a map that I played through, like a PvP map specifically, that I played on Destiny 1. And I got into it. I'm like, this map looks so familiar. Why do I know this map? I'm like, oh my God, this is Venus. This is the map from Venus.
Yes.
And now it's on Nessus.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Same maps.
You know, I didn't realize, like, I thought something seemed off on the map. I was like, I know this map. This is from Destiny 1. And it didn't occur to me that, oh, it's not the exact same. It's different, because I'm like, oh no, I know this corner and I know that spot there, and if you go in there you come out there, and I'm like, yeah, this is what I've been wanting from this game. And yeah, it never occurred to me that
it was the same thing, right?
It never occurred to me that it was literally the same thing. Yeah, that's hilarious. I'm glad they did that though, because I enjoyed that map. I didn't suck as much as I normally do.
Yeah, so then we also had, even if you, I didn't think anything could be hated more than DLC. And then microtransactions that hold my beer.
Microtransactions come along and you're like, wow, DLC was actually a fair deal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that DLC hurts the mobile market more, you know? I mean, there's some, I'm not a big fan of mobile games because I'll get involved in a mobile game that I kind of like, right? And then all of a sudden, oh, now you got to do the microtransaction thing or else you're not going to make progress. Like Fallout Shelter, for example. I would say for Fallout Shelter, $15, maybe $20 to get it without all the stuff that stops you from playing it. Because if you don't spend money on microtransactions in that game, you will get overrun. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, you can't keep that shelter going forever.
So that's not pay to win as much as it's pay to not lose.
Yeah, exactly. It's pay to survive. Like you can get a certain distance or a certain length of that game. But if you just like, if you know microtransactions, then eventually you'll just peter out. But
I thought pay to survive was called capitalism.
It is, Nick. Yeah, but you know, yeah, I think microtransactions really hurt the mobile market more, but microtransactions have hurt I would say standard game platforms as well. Like look at the card packs that they put into the sports games and stuff like that.
I still don't understand I've played those games and I don't, I mean, I'm not asking for an explanation now. I'm just saying like, maybe this is me being old, but I understand it, but on a fundamental level, I don't understand it and I don't want to understand it.
The card packs in FIFA cause like this black market account theft ring where, and this also had to do with the fact that Microsoft's security or anti-phishing procedures that they have just were not great. Because what people would do is they would fish your access to your Xbox Live account. And if your account had FIFA on it, right, they would then pop, obviously they have the FIFA disc, they pop it in, they sign into your account, pop it in, and basically just max your credit card out with card packs and then sell your account to somebody else. And you could not get your money back, by the way, from Microsoft. Microsoft would not refund you, and then your credit card company may not help you with the fraud. Because the credit card company is like, well, they didn't use your credit card on, like, you know, directly. Your account was linked to it, and that's how they used it. So, yeah. So, microtransactions, hated even more than DLC. I would say the only type of additional revenue that has that hasn't really made gamers angry is battle passes. And I think that's because you get stuff, you know, they're like $10 every quarter, essentially, or every whatever, however long a season takes to go in your game. I think in Apex is like every quarter. So you spend $10 every quarter, which is $40 a year, you know. And you get additional stuff. The developer gets additional stuff. That stuff being money. You know,
it's kind of funny that we had like the MMO with their $15 subscription back in like 2004, you know, mid 2000s era. And that kind of petered out. And it's like the subscription concept went away and it's now kind of back, but it's, instead of it being like $15 a month, it's like $10 every 3 months. So it's a much smaller subscription. Optional. Yeah.
It's optional. I think it's almost like it replaces the demo. Like the demo was supposed to get you to buy the game.
Right.
And now basically the game is free to play. But if you want this stuff, you can pay additional for it. And the thing about the Battle Pass stuff, it's all cosmetic. Well, for some games, it's all cosmetic. Like I know with Apex, it's all cosmetic. Fortnite, it's all cosmetic. But I think with Destiny, you actually get certain weapons with the battle passes. You either get them exclusively or you get them faster.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like I said, that I have heard some complaints about battle passes, but not nearly as much as I've heard about the DLC and microtransactions. But I guess that leads us to this question. Because if Sean Layton is saying this, he's not like a guru. He's not like a guru or like a games industry prophet, right? Like he looks at what's happening and he analyzes just like other people in his sector. So with that being the case, are we going to see more expensive games at the baseline price point for the PS5 and the Xbox Series X? I mean, 2K already kind of answered it, because 2K for the PS5 and the Xbox Series X will be $70.
Wasn't there a game or a developer that was trying to up the game's price to $70 before? Wasn't there a game that came out at $70 and everybody was like, this is going to herald the new price point for games? And it didn't, because we're having this discussion now.
What game was that? Because I cannot remember.
I don't remember, but I feel like we talked about this on a MASHcast. So it had to be around like 2012.
Nah, I don't think so. I think that really got replaced with the DLC and the microtransactions. But yeah, in this case, I think we might see some games that are more expensive, especially as they try to figure this out. What Sean Layton suggests is that they just make smaller games and keep them at the $60 price point. But the funny thing is, he's talking about smaller games at 15 hours or so. I'm like, I don't consider that a small game. You know, Doom Eternal for $60, if you play it on normal, is a 15-hour game. If you play it on a harder difficulty, it is probably closer to 20 hours, depending on how you do. But yeah, like 15 hours on a small game. You know, another time where they actually did start making smaller games. They're like, this has happened already. Higher price point, but a smaller game. When did Gears of War come out? 2006 or 2005?
Let me see. Either of those sounds right to me.
Gears of War, when that came out, everybody was shocked how small that game was. Because the game essentially was between 5 to 8 hours, depending on how good you were at it. Somewhere between 5 to 8 hours. Also, remember, Call of Duty Modern Warfare, or Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, was only about a 7 to 8 hour campaign. I think Modern Warfare was a little longer. But Modern Warfare 2 most certainly was only somewhere between 6 to 8 hours. Modern Warfare 3 was only 6 to 8 hours. Black Ops was only 6 to 8 hours. I think the campaigns only got longer. Started getting longer again very recently. Even Advanced Warfare wasn't that long, the campaign.
But the thing about like a Call of Duty game, though, is that yes, their single player is important, but that's not what they hang their hat on necessarily. So, I mean, I think like a Gears of War game, that's a better example, because that's where the first player experience is more representative of what the game is.
Yeah, but the thing about Call of Duty is before Modern Warfare 2, they always had solid single players.
I'm not saying that they didn't, but I think
very solid single players.
I don't want to just flat out say like nobody bought Call of Duty for the single player, but it's always been very much a multiplayer experience. And yes, the single player, while it comports itself well, and you know, they put effort into it and not. It's not primarily a multiplayer game. I think it's kind of both, but it's not the kind of game where it's just the single player. I think what Layton's talking about is just a single player game that only has a 15-hour experience and you know, like more akin to Doom. Although Doom has multiplayer, right?
Yeah, nobody plays it.
That's a shame.
Well, no, it's not what you think it should be. Trust me.
Well, that's what I mean, is that it's a shame that it's not what I'm thinking it should be. It should be whatever their multiplayer is. It should be something that people should want to play and are playing. The fact that nobody's playing means that somebody did something wrong.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily mind a $70 title as long as I felt it was worth it. It does. I totally understand the fact that a lot of people are like, no, like they're already having a hard enough time getting enough money to pay for a $60 game. A lot of people. Why are you making your eyes like that?
How many copies? I get that people are saying like, oh, you know, it's hard to scrounge together money. This is not the best time to be having this discussion with the economy being in the state that it's in. That said, how many copies did The Last of Us 2 just sell?
4 million at least over the weekend.
But if that game costs $10 more, if that game costs $10 more, how many copies do you think that sells?
It still sells 4 million.
Right. So, like, I don't know, maybe, I mean, I'm not saying every game should cost $70, and maybe that's, you know, and I think we're kind of seeing that. If you look at some of the digital games, and especially how people will tend to wait to buy stuff. I myself just finally bought Horizon Zero Dawn, the complete edition, for $20 off the PlayStation Store. But I feel like for those games that come out that you have to have them, in a way, it's almost like no price is too high. Go, you know, try, you know, not every game, but a game that's well hyped, like The Last of Us 2, that you know people are going to buy. Try it at $100. See what you sell, because I bet you can move that curve with supply and demand and the price point. I bet you can push it up and make a little bit more money than what you're doing right now.
Yeah, but that's an established IP. The same thing about The Last of Us, an established IP. What if Horizon Zero Dawn just flat out, like when it came out in 2017, was $100?
I wouldn't recommend that one. You don't do it on new IP. But
that would make
for sequels.
Your sequels, maybe. But that's what I'm saying. Like, new IPs, which will, they're also going to be these massive new games that may need to be $70, $80, but you don't have that type of luxury for a brand new IP. Make it $70, $80. Like, people are like, no, fuck no. Like, Horizon Forbidden West, if they made it like $70, $80, $100, people are going to buy it. I'd buy it, you know?
I think the one new IP that they could do is what was the game that they showed with the cat with the backpack? Because everybody loved that on my timeline. I think they pay any amount of money for that.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's way more dangerous for new IP, you know? Because, I mean, look at how many people bought, like, Days Gone, for example. That game, I don't know, somebody might like that game. I most certainly did not, you know? And for $60, I'm like, ugh. You know, it's hard enough swallowing a bad $60 game. Now you got to swallow a bad $70, $80 game. Like, it's what it would do is it would cause people to wait longer to get the game, right? And then I think you have a Borderlands 3 situation, right? Borderlands 3, super hyped. Epic Store only. That caused a lot of people not to buy it immediately. And then people start playing it. People start seeing the little problems that it had. Confirmation bias, like, see, look, it's not even that good, we don't need to buy it. And what happens? Layoffs, no bonuses at Gearbox because it doesn't sell to expectations. And I think that's what you will end up seeing if you price the games too high. So yeah, I mean, I think I heard a little rumor that the next Grand Theft Auto on launch is going to be smaller than GTA 5 on launch. And then they'll have updates over time that makes it bigger.
That makes sense.
That's a rumor. Yeah, because it's like, okay, fine. You put the game out at $60 at smaller. Everybody buys the game. And then a year later, maybe you have new content. Maybe even six months later, you have new content. You know,
that makes sense because, I mean, how much money have they made from Grand Theft Auto 5 Online? And right. That's basically like the MMO model is like you put out a game, here's the world. And then every 2 years or so, here's an expansion where, you know, with a new place, new content, all new stuff. And then, you know, you just keep getting the money that way. That's kind of what the Sims do, although they don't have like a world, but yeah, that model works. That's a very effective way to do things. So yeah, I'm fine with Grand Theft Auto doing that. Disclaimer. I haven't played Grand Theft Auto since San Andreas. So of course I'd be fine with that.
And the thing about that though, like these massive open worlds, like Red Dead, Grand Theft Auto, how many people actually do everything in the game? I spent 50 hours in Red Dead Redemption 2. And I know I probably only did like 60% of the stuff. Maybe a little bit more than that. You know, I think Horizon Zero Dawn was actually a really well paced and, in terms of, it wasn't overflowing with things to do. I did everything in that game except like the little like sun challenges. I even did those. I just didn't get the maximum amount of suns for each one, you know?
Well, isn't that like the great development question though? Like how much, Like all that other stuff, like you have your main campaign, you know that that's necessary, that the core, you know, 10, 12, 15, 20 hours, whatever it is, that part of it, that's the game itself. But then you got all this, you know, filler content, and not to treat it like filler content, but that's kind of what it is, that, you know, in some ways it makes the world more immersive, but in other ways it's just busy work to keep you busy, to make you feel like you're justifying this experience. But how much time is of, and how much money of the development process is actually spent on that? Is that the kind of thing where it's, you've got developers like, oh, hey, I finished the main project, let me throw these little, you know, achievements in here or there where you can go collect things that are hidden, and, you know, I'll do this since I'm not working on anything else? Or is this something where, you know, it's planned from the beginning and you've got developers, you know, that's their whole job, is to, you know, hide knickknacks in the game so that you can find them later. And, you know, and that's part of the thing, because if it's the latter, then Layden's comments make more sense, that it's like, okay, like kind of scale back your overall production, just focus on the core experience. Yes. The overall, instead of it being a, you know, a 60, 70, 80 hour experience, it might be 20 or 40, whatever that core game is going to be. Just focus on that. It'll make the cost cheaper and you can get that out, versus the other way where it's like, well, we're kind of doing that anyway. And, oh, this is, it's really, it's marginal in the development costs, but it actually gets a decent ROI as far as the, you know, the gameplay value, because yeah, you've got people that are going to go through, they want their 100% on the achievements. They want, you know, to get everything. And this gives them something to do so that, you know, they'll regard the game more fondly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, actually another great example, I think, of a game that was packaged well is God of War. Because you have your main game, which has a ton of stuff in it. Don't get me wrong, a ton of stuff in the game. But it's manageable to get the vast majority of stuff in the game within about, I want to say, 20 to 30 hours of main gameplay. But then for people, like, let's say God of War is the... Because the people you got to worry about are the people who only buy like one or two games a year, you know, and they're expecting to get a certain amount of play out of the game. They don't want to feel like, you know, they don't want to feel like it wasn't worth it. So the God of War also has post-game content, like official post-game content. Like, if you're playing the game, it is high, like, in, if you're in the main portion of the game, it's highly unlikely that you'll be able to get this stuff done unless you just hold off and do it first, right? So they have this maze that you can go into, and the maze changes every time you go into it. There's a time limit for how long you could be in it. And you get loot and stuff like that. The other post-game content are the Valkyries and the Valkyrie Queen, which if you can beat that, like, you're a champ. Like, it's tough. Like, it's not impossible, but it is tough. But that's, by the time I finished doing that stuff, I was good. I was like, I love this game. If I'm finished, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm officially done with this game. But so, yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, if developers take that approach to it, like, maybe Red Dead doesn't have to have all those additional voice lines. Like, the Red Dead Redemption 2 was some artistic crazy shit. Like, I mean, like, you know, you could just start following people in that game and they will start having conversations with you. It's crazy, man. Like, the way the world works and everything, it's an incredible amount of detail that I think most people won't even recognize.
Didn't they have the contracting horse balls?
Yes, they did. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, it might have just been too much, but it was amazing. It was one of the best games ever made for that reason. But at the same time, every minute costs. Because that's what it is. You're paying for labor, man. Like, that's the thing. Every minute costs. And that's what you got to really look at. Now, then again, it is Rockstar. It is Take-Two. They have a slew of just mega titles. Anytime, I mean, that new Grand Theft that comes out is going to break sales records. It's gonna completely eclipse probably anything before it. I mean, shit, the new Halo is probably gonna have some crazy sales records, you know? So bigger studios have those options, but it's funny because bigger studios have those options, but then we have smaller indie studios who they're only gonna deliver you 10 to 15, maybe 20 hour game, and they're gonna be super tight on the budget, so they have that. So it's kind of like everybody in the middle.
Well, I think,
you know,
I think Sony would behoove itself to really look at making sure that they cover, you know, the high end experience, you know, with your 60, your 70, you know, $80 experience maybe. But then also, yeah, you know, make sure that they have a deal where they can have some like indie games that they're getting in that $10 to $20 experience.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So you got anything before we wrap up here?
No, I just think it's funny that I think you're very bearish on price points Because it's the same discussion with the consoles, where you're like, can't be more than like $400, otherwise everything's going to shit. And I'm like, no, they can make it like $1,000, and it'll still sell. They'll be fine. It's the same thing. I'm like, no, make the games more expensive. I don't care. I ain't buying them. It's not for me.
All right, so that's going to be it from us today. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to keep up with what's going on with the show in the Mash Button Network, you can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/TheMashNetwork. Nick, why don't you tell them where they can find you?
I am at WookieBH on Twitter. You can also find me here on the Mash Those Buttons Network on WoW Talk, our World of Warcraft guild and community news podcast, and also on The Torn and the Goblin, our World of Warcraft story and lore podcast. So check those out.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at Jostradamus. You can also find me streaming on our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/mashthosebuttons. So if you want to know when that goes live, just give us a follow there. You can also join our Discord, which is mash.gg/discord. Love to have you there. You can talk to me and Nick and meet some of the other people in the Discord. We encourage you guys to, you know, reach out to the show with comments and questions. So you can either reach out via Discord or the Twitters we mentioned, or you can also contact us at contact@mash.gg. If you enjoy the show and you want to help us out, and the best way to do it is to share the show with others and to rate and review on your favorite podcast platform of choice. If you want to take your support a bit further, you can do so on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/mashthosebuttons, and you can help support Mash Those Buttons with tiers starting at $1 a month. You can gain early access to content as well as exclusive content. We do also have a Teespring store, which is teespring.com/store/mashthosebuttons. And you can also drop a Twitch subscription if you want to, if you'd like to show your support that way. And we encourage you guys to stay tuned after the show to learn more about Mash Those Buttons. And with that, we are done. Thank you very much. We will catch you later.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to a Mash Those Buttons production. If you enjoyed the show, you should check out mashthosebuttons.com and see if any of our other shows might interest you. All of our shows are available on your podcast platform of choice like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. If you enjoy our content, you can help support Mash Those Buttons by becoming a patron at patreon.com/mashthosebuttons, where you can receive Patreon bonuses for as little as $1 a month. You can connect with Mash Those Buttons at twitter.com/TheMashNetwork, facebook.com/MashThoseButtons, or join our Discord at mash.gg/discord.